The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rantz, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rantz, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
We will take you through the latest madness out of Olympia. You're not going to want to miss this bill we're going to talk about with State Senator John Braun. We'll take you through a complaint from some folks that Tamer Abouzeid, the director of a law enforcement oversight agency, appears to be an anti-Semite. Plus, Ian Pryor, you know him from Loudoun County, pushing back against the outrageous school nonsense going on. He's going to explain to you exactly how you can push back as parents. We're going to get into that this hour of the Jason Rantz Show. So let's dive in.
The monologue.
Donald Trump was not, in fact, indicted today. We now are hearing that it's going to happen next week. We know that tomorrow morning will be the last witness that the grand jury will hear from before voting on whether or not they're going to indict the former president. You have folks who at this point are acknowledging that this is not at all an easy case to prove. We told you yesterday that the federal government looked into the charges, looked into this very issue stemming from payments made to Stormy Daniels. And they said, yeah, there's not a crime here that we can prove. There's nothing here. And at that point, they were looking at it as a misdemeanor. So then you get Alvin Bragg, who's a George Soros-backed DA, who is deeply politically partisan, who does not charge misdemeanors. He barely charges felonies. But he decided to take a case for a misdemeanor and try to elevate it to a felony, a Class E felony charge. There are people who know that this is bogus. People know on the left that this is an abuse of power, and yet they're okay with it anyway. Listen to the way Congressman Mike Quigley, he's a Democrat from Illinois, talked about this issue on CNN.
You've got to appreciate, it's a little surreal for me to watch all this. I voted to impeach President Trump because I thought he attempted to extort an ally for political gain. I voted to impeach President Trump because he incited an insurrection that almost brought our country down.
If anyone believes January 6th almost brought our country down, you have no clue at all as to what it is you're talking about. You must not have seen anything that happened on January 6th. You must just be told about it from people like Mike Quigley.
And now he possibly could get indicted for something so seemly and messy. Maybe that's appropriate. Maybe that speaks more of the man, that he's never been held accountable. And it's something like this that maybe finally catches up to him.
This is so funny. Yeah, this is a really messy case. It's obviously a joke. But it would be kind of fun if that's what got him. They're not hiding their glee. You have on The View, Sunny Hostin, TV's dumbest lawyer. Remember, she is a lawyer, the dumbest lawyer on TV, but she's a lawyer. And she said this.
The severity matters a little less than how easy it's going to prove. Mm-hmm. Many of the charges that they're looking at are falsifying business records. We know he's done that for a really long time. Mm-hmm. He's claimed to be a gazillionaire. He's provided these records. His chief financial officer is actually in prison right now at Rikers, serving time for falsifying business records. Right. So it wouldn't be a difficult thing to prove.
Okay. Now, she says that with some level of confidence, but you and I both know. TV's dumbest lawyer, Sonny Hostin. So Eli Honig, who's a former assistant U.S. attorney, he was on CNN to say, okay, oh my God, no, this isn't going
to
be easy.
It's easy to prove the paper crime if the person's name is on the paper. Here, the paper trail can show us exactly how this payment was made, exactly how Michael Cohen was reimbursed, and exactly how they booked it. But what I'd be shocked if the paperwork showed is a direct link to Donald Trump. If there's an email, a text, a memo, where Donald Trump says, yes, guys, do it this way, or I'd like you to do it this way, that's a smoking gun. But short of that, the paperwork's an important part of the story. But just saying it's a paper case, there's a paper trail, doesn't necessarily get you to the core issue of the defendant or the potential defendant's criminal liability.
He said that on CNN. They are all gleefully waiting for the indictment to come. And I have no doubt that Honig, he is a Democrat, he's a lefty, wants this to happen too. But he has at least a little sense of pride and a little bit of an intellect that Sonny Hostin doesn't have. So he's at least being honest about this. Anyone who's telling you, anyone who tells you that this is an easy case is flat out lying, or they just simply don't know what it is they're talking about. I was talking to someone yesterday who made the claim. He tried to compare this to when you put your name on on your tax report. Is your name on it? Is Donald's name on it? Done. That's a crime. That's not how it works. So I have someone who prepares my taxes. Most people do. You go to, you know, H&R Block or some service or whatever. You pull up an app and you do it that way. If they make a mistake and you don't know about it, and you literally don't know about it, you're not the one going to jail for something that happened. They're going to have to prove that you actually knew it. There are some cases where you don't have to prove. You just have to have been involved. Yeah, that's not happening here. And if anyone thinks Donald Trump, let's say he's found guilty, you think Donald Trump's going to jail? Really? I know that that's one of your fantasies, lefties who hate listening to the show. Thank you for that. You really think he's going to jail for this? There are people who commit violent acts who are not put in jail. Well, Michael Cohen went to jail. Yeah, because he's the one who committed the crime, not Donald Trump. And again, are we could we be surprised, to Honig's point, of some smoking gun? I guess. Something tells me it would have been leaked by now, because they've leaked everything else. This is a politically partisan witch hunt. It was from the beginning. Now they're moving forward, knowing that it's an abuse, and they don't care what it means to the system. And you know what? They want to dismantle it anyway, so I guess this does kind of make sense.
The interview.
Okay, so you're a parent. You realize what's going on in your kid's school is just a little bit too much, that the schools are paying less attention to, you know, the basics of academics, and instead they're leaning into wokeness. Well, let's talk to someone who actually knows how to unite and push back and win. He's the author of Parents of the World Unite, How to Save Our Schools from the Left's Radical Agenda. It's out right now. Ian Pryor, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So people know that something's going on. They felt uncomfortable for a while. They're seeing others organize, but it's probably difficult at the beginning. So what should parents do?
Well, you know, first pick up a copy of the book and pick up two copies and send one to your wokest acquaintance for April Fool's Day. But beyond that, you know, I think, you know, chapter two, I really get into activate, investigate, communicate. And it's important that, one, you believe in the fight, of course, but that you're ready to take on that fight, right? And ready to take on the slings and arrows. But then you have to establish your network. And, you know, whether that's through creating a, you know, a Facebook group or reaching out to others that have been involved and figuring out, you know, really the best way to approach this as a team. Now, you're not going to win this as, you know, one individual or a few individuals, but you really need to create a battle unit. Just like you would assemble a team in sports or in the military, and you delegate different things to folks. And you need to investigate. You need investigators out there. You need parents that know how to investigate. You need parents that know how to get people to events that can rally people to your cause. You need parents that, you know how to go on TV, know how to spread a message, know how to give a great school board speech. And you need an intel network, too. I mean, there's something to be said for having people in the schools, whether it's teachers, administrators, you know, even elected officials that are on your side that are helping guide you to the information and where you need to go. And then you need to really, you know, deliver that through the media to the people to win hearts and minds and bring more people to your cause. And so this book kind of operates a little bit like Sun Tzu for school boards and parents pushing back on schools. And it goes through really 12 lessons that we learned in our fight in Loudoun County, you know, over the course of 3 years. And, you know, I think it's a valuable tool for people that are really looking to be effective, strategic, tactical, and be able to operationalize in a way that can have meaningful change.
what happened in Loudoun County had happened in other school boards and school districts in the past, maybe not at the same level, but parents have been fighting back for a while. What do you think it was about this particular issue that got the attention of not just national media, but the electorate? I mean, that played a key role in Glenn Youngkin winning his election.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, like many school districts, Loudoun County's fight really starts in 2020. And that was before I even got on the scene and parents were organizing these groups to go and try and reopen schools. But, you know, schools were closed in a lot of places. So what made Loudoun County really different? Well, I entered the scene slightly in the fall of 2020 when, you know, I did a Freedom of Information Act request, found out about one of these equity consultants that came in, did an equity audit. And charged $500,000 for their services, mm-hmm. and then continued on for $625 an hour for 2 years to implement these equity programs. Well, in March of 2021, there was a private Facebook group called the Anti-Racist Parents of Loudoun County, since renamed by us Chardonnay Antifa, that contained six school board members, our Soros-backed prosecutor, and they created really a list of insufficiently woke parents that spoke at school board meetings, and you know they needed to infiltrate our groups and publicly expose us. And you know, one individual even suggested hacking websites and redirecting them to, you know, pro critical race theory websites. And that lit a match,
yeah.
And that was really what galvanized people together to go out there and do something about it. And you know, we started with petitions to remove school board members, and we were doing this all in the context and in the spotlight of really one state that was the focus of elections in 2021, which was Virginia. So we knew that we were going to use that spotlight to really bring attention to the issues in our school district and really school districts everywhere, as Loudoun County being a microcosm of everything that was happening in the country.
And I always tell folks that, sure, it kind of feels vulnerable when you're the one who stands up and says something. But the first person who does that, they find out very quickly that there are a lot of other people who think exactly the same way as they do. And all of a sudden, you're no longer a single person fighting something. It's an army of parents in this case. It is so clear that we are on the right side of these issues. People just need a little bit of courage to be the first one to stand up in their community. And then I think it inspires other people to stand up.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we, you know, in our drive in 2021 to gather signatures to remove certain school board members, we collected, I think, 25,000 signatures. And we had other people stand up, too. We had Tanner Cross, a teacher, who spoke at a school board meeting about a transgender bathroom policy. And he was suspended for speaking at a school board meeting. Now, he won his case. It was affirmed at the Supreme Court. But he stood up and he inspired more people to come out. And it just kept going and rolling and rolling and rolling. And then eventually then candidate Youngkin started speaking at rallies in mm-hmm. Loudoun County. And it just took on this life of its own as parents realized, you know, I'm going to fight this. And we really were able to develop a bit of a machine. Now, when you're going up against a $1.6 billion, you know, bureaucratic organization, on one hand, it can be intimidating, but look, they're slow, they're cumbersome, they have to decide everything by committee, they're very limited in what they can do. And when you have parents that are smart, strategic, tactical, and nimble, you're able to really get a lot accomplished very quickly. And that's what we were able to do. And I think that parents can learn from our lessons and do it in their school communities as well.
And you break all those lessons down for folks to follow. It's very easy to follow. It gives you the blueprint. Purchase Parents of the World Unite, How to Save Our Schools from the Left's Radical Agenda. It came out today. It's available where all books are sold. Ian Pryor, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Now this.
The interview.
So yesterday we told you about the radical anti-police activist who runs an agency that oversees and investigates police. Well, it turns out that Tamer Abuzaid dislikes one other group of people, probably seemingly way more than he dislikes the police, Jews. In particular, when you look at his Twitter account, you see a lot of stuff just attacking the very existence of Israel and the right to exist. Joining me on the line, someone who I haven't spoken to in a long time, which generally is a good sign in this case. Regina Sassoon Friedland is the regional director for the American Jewish Committee. Usually, Regina, when you and I talk, it's because of a significant incident of anti-Semitism. And so it felt like things were going reasonably well over the course of the last couple of years or so, at least locally. And then this happens. You've seen some of his tweets. What was your reaction?
I'd like to say I was surprised. I don't know if I was so much surprised. I was appalled. I found it to be very disturbing that someone who has made such comments via Twitter, via some opinion pieces, that they would be put in a position of authority like that. I mean, now essentially a public official and the director of a pretty important agency. So it's very concerning to me.
And a lot of this is just really vile. So the official account for the state of Israel posted a video celebrating 75 years of independence. And Tamer retweets the video saying, "Sorry, can't see it through all the blood on the camera lens." This is someone who repeatedly accuses the state of Israel of genocide and ethnic cleansing. Explain for folks why that is put into the umbrella of anti-Semitism.
Well, rhetoric like that, it crosses right in. You might start out, if he was simply criticizing governmental policies of the state of Israel, I might not agree with him, but that's not anti-Semitic. That is just his opinion, having, just like you could criticize Israel as you would any other government. The problem is when it crosses over, and it's not as easy for those to recognize, especially when it involves Israel. It might be, whether it's peddled by him or others, it leaves Jews as a target, Jewish institutions. We see this often, especially in this area, with where graffiti starts out anti-Zionist, anti-Israel, and it morphs right into straight things that acute, you know, where they'll talk about the character of a Jew. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's when you go on that line, you're not making a differentiation, and you're putting Jews in a very vulnerable spot. You're opening them up to be targets for your aggressive speech.
Well, and it's that speech and idea that makes them a target in Israel. And, you know, you've got folks who believe that Israel is built upon stolen land, that it committed a genocide to get it, which is verifiably false. But you have a statement made by Tamer over in the Chicago Tribune back in 2001 that I was able to get. And he writes, "In Israel/Palestine, and Palestine doesn't exist, the Palestinians who die for their cause are called terrorists. The only reason they are called so is because their attacks are not planned by a government. The Israeli army has killed more people, used heavier weapons and artillery, and left hundreds homeless, all following the commands of one man, Ariel Sharon. How then could the Palestinians who die, proving a point that could only be proven this way, be called terrorists? It's unfair." Is it unfair?
When you take aggressive actions like that, on the offense, I mean, there are other words that he talks about, Hamas, which is a terror organization, and deemed a terror organization in 1997 by all 27 members of the European Union, Canada, and Japan. They all mark it as such. And his words on Hamas are very disturbing, because Hamas is dedicated solely to eliminating the state of Israel. And any Arab leaders who have expressed willingness to meet and explore prospects of peace with Israel or anything like that, even including Mahmoud Abbas, Hamas has a problem with that. That's not going to work. And it's in the Hamas charter itself, it says something to the effect of Israel will exist and continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it, just as it obliterated others before. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's not my opinion. It's in their charter. And it's concerning to me if you have someone who is has publicly been a proponent of views like that. I worry about the consequences.
Yeah, God forbid a Jewish officer is put in front of Tamer. I am terrified of the treatment that investigation would get. Last question for you. What do you want to see happen? The King County Council today is meeting. They've talked about this. What would you like to see happen?
I'm very surprised that he's in this role, and I hope that the King County Council would rethink this, and when they make future decisions about putting someone in a position that carries so much weight and as a leader, I think it is very important to look at their rhetoric. I know that often governing agencies try to make a distinction between what is commented as a private person and commented on from the public account. But the reality of that is it's very hard to make a distinction between the two. I'm not talking about the legalities of that, if there's a difference. I'm talking about practically how people relate to that. It's just, how are you going to mark a distinction? You agree with him here for these sets of principles, but you don't agree with him on that. It's one person. And if he's, listen, some people have the ability to make changes. If there's an openness, I just haven't seen anything like that. If you're willing to, some of the tweets I said were pretty recent.
Within the last several months. I mean, when you go prior to November of 2020, it would appear that those tweets were deleted. So we'll follow up to see where this goes. We're running out of time here. We've been talking with Regina Sassoon Friedland. She is the regional director for the American Jewish Committee, the Seattle chapter. Their website, ajc.org. I hope you'll check it out because they do some really, really great work. Regina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing us these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
Democrats gave us a carbon tax. They also gave us a way higher gas bill. When you're filling up your car, joining me on the line to discuss this just complete disaster, State Senator John Braun, the minority leader. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Jason.
We were told that the carbon tax would not really impact us at the gas pump. If it did, it would be relatively minor. That's not the reality, is it?
No, not even close. I think the governor claimed it would be only pennies. Well, I guess it is pennies, but it's lots of pennies, right? So, and it's getting more. What we saw, as you're probably aware, just over a week ago, they had their first auction, and the sale of the certificates for emitting carbon, and the auction prices went over two times the price that was advertised when the bill was put forward a couple years ago. And, of course, what that means is the cost to citizens in the state of Washington, largely through gas prices, is going to be two times what they thought it would be.
Have they said anything maybe behind the scenes about some kind of relief or maybe some kind of fix?
No, that's actually the most frustrating part about this. Well, maybe not the most frustrating, but we constantly have this litany about, the sales, the tax system in Washington is regressive, and you must do things to help folks who are, are struggling or paying a disproportionate share of their income in taxes. And yet here we have this bill, the most regressive bill passed in, I would say, in our state's history. We just found out the price is not going to be just bad. It's going to be over twice as bad as what was expected. And crickets, nothing. No willingness at all to provide any relief to the cost of gas or anything else, any other kind of taxes in the state of Washington.
Well, they would first have to acknowledge the problem. And not only are they not acknowledging the tax hike, the media isn't really covering it.
No, they're getting a pass from the media, who think, you know, they have to do their part in the climate battle, and that's the other sad part about this is this
doesn't
bill.
Help.
It's been proven in places other places in the country and in the world who've run cap and tax system. It does almost nothing to reduce the emission of carbon. All it does is put another burden on the people of the state of Washington to live here.
But isn't that the purpose? It's to put a burden on car ownership. They've been actively, Democrats on a hyper-local level, but at the state level, have been trying to get people out of cars, and this is one way to do that.
I think you're right there. They are opposed to carbon to cars, and making, you know, cars bad because they emit carbon is one way to get out of that. Of course, you know, that's not solving the bigger their bigger problem, and it's making what it is reducing opportunities, economic opportunities, mm-hmm. for folks. You know, this doesn't get talked about a lot, but if you are say you're living in Seattle and you have the ability to drive to your work, your economic opportunities, the opportunities you have for employment, go up by a factor of three versus if you have to take the bus because of the amount of time it takes to get to and from work. So we're locking people in to lives of poverty because we collectively, I'm talking about the majorities here in Olympia, are opposed to giving them the freedom to drive cars.
Yeah, and it's in a lot of ways, it's even worse than that. I mean, think about it in these terms. Let's use your Seattle example. You've got someone who's able to walk to work or take the bike or ride a bike, and you've got someone who's struggling to get to their two jobs. Generally speaking, that Seattleite who's local, they're not only wealthy, they tend to be white. And the person who's working job to job in the same day to put food on their table, generally speaking, is going to be a person of color. And we're told over and over and over again about the white privilege and about, you know, equity concerns. And yet they are actively hurting the very people that they claim to want to help.
Yes, this whole thing flies in the face of the words they say. This has the largest impact on disadvantaged communities across our state that are already struggling, already barely able to make ends meet, and we're taking more, you know, pennies, lots of them, out of their pocket that they could use to pay their rent, to pay their mortgage, to feed their family, for health care, for child care, for and it's just wrong. I mean, it is the hypocrisy of what is said they want and what they're actually doing to people of the state is just wrong.
I'm talking with John Braun, state senator from Centralia. Let's switch gears and talk about a bill that is not getting a whole lot of coverage at all. It's a bill that would release what they call incarcerated individuals well prior to the expiration of their sentence. And the way that I'm reading this bill, it would even apply to the most serious of criminals.
Yeah, which bill number are you referring to? Are you talking about the sentencing enhancements or the release one?
Oh, the release ones. 1189 on the House side.
Yeah,
it's already.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this is absurd.
Yeah, this is a really bad bill, and this is a bill that, frankly, the Senate Democrats have promoted for 2 years, and they passed it over on a party-line vote 2 years in a row. Actually, we've had some Democrats come along with us, but not enough to stop the bill. This year, the bill is coming over from the House, which doesn't bode well because the last 2 years it's died in the House. But this is a bill that completely changes the makeup of the Clemency and Pardons Board that releases folks who have not served their time. It changes the criteria so that we're going to see, you know, likely hundreds of people who have committed, in many cases, very serious crimes released before they have completed their sentence back into the public. And this is on top of a 40-year high in crime, violent and nonviolent crime. They think this is somehow a step in the right direction. It's just, again, it's wrongheaded. It's not listening. It's tone deaf to the challenges the average Washingtonian is facing around our state.
But again, they get away with it because issues like this don't get coverage. When we hear bills about this get coverage, let's say it's King 5 News that does it. They'll focus on a reformed, armed robber who committed this act when he was, 22 years old. And they'll present it in a way that only focuses on a positive when those are the exceptions to the rule.
Right. And not looking at the risks and the impact and they're also, you know, kind of ignoring the victims of yep. these crimes over time. It's all focused on the criminals, and with zero or very little focus on the victims who have had to suffer sometimes from very violent and difficult crimes, and it's taken our state in the wrong direction. And this, again, put it in context of the crime wave we are living through right now, mm-hmm. today, and this is somehow believed to be an important item we need to deal with. It does not make sense to me.
At the same time, you and I yesterday talked about one particular bill. I can't remember the number, but it gets rid of a requirement to know how to read and write in English for civil service jobs, law enforcement jobs.
Yes, that was Senate Bill 5274, and this is a kind of a quiet little bill that does a crazy thing. It just says you don't have to read or write English to perform a civil servant job. And while, you know, I don't begrudge anybody that is struggling with reading or writing sure. English if they come from another country, who should, there are a lot of services available to help folks learn English, and as there should be. But these are folks who are supposed to deliver services to our citizens around the state. Certainly, if they're bilingual, that's actually valuable. Oftentimes, they're paid more, mm-hmm. multilingual. But to think that you can somehow function, deliver services in our society without being able to read or write English, I think is, again, wrong-headed. Let's, you know, if folks are having trouble, let's help them learn, but let's not put them in a position where they're asked to, you know, serve other citizens when they can't communicate with them.
Yeah, and especially consider the fact that you've got law enforcement officers who have to compile reports. And if you make a mistake on a report, it could have significant implications as far as a criminal getting off of a charge.
That's right. And whether it's law enforcement or any number of things, a licensure, human services, anything, if public servant or public employees make a mistake in the way they communicate, it can have a devastating impact to citizens. And we're setting both the potential employee who doesn't know how to read or write or speak English setting them up for failure and setting our citizens up for failure. It doesn't make sense. I get the idea that we want to help people be successful, and I'm supportive of that, but this seems like a wrong-headed way to do it.
Yeah, I think that's probably an understatement. Do you sometimes just sit back and say, what in God's name is going on here? How have we gone this far?
It certainly passes through my mind periodically.
it's
you know, we have certain things we've heard again from folks around the state. You know, they want us to fix public safety.
Yeah.
These bills we've talked about today don't do that. They wanted to make it affordable in Washington. Again, these bills seem to work counter to that. They want to make sure their kids have a quality education. And we're, instead of focusing on these issues that are most important, we're weighed out on the ideological sidelines doing bills that are mostly virtue signaling.
Yeah, it's madness. We've been talking with State Senator John Braun, the minority leader from Centralia. Thank you so much for stopping by, as always.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
So there's a really curious way the media decides to cover certain people in the so-called conservative media space or sphere. Space or sphere, whatever it is you want to call it. It doesn't just mean Fox News. It doesn't just mean Newsmax. It doesn't even just mean radio, right? Obviously, conservative talk radio is significant. It is a force to be reckoned with. You guys know that. But the idea of sort of lumping someone into a position that reflects a greater role than they have is often utilized by bad faith activists in the media to smear conservatives. There's some guy I've never heard of. His name is Pete Santilli. The chances are you've never heard of him either. And yet there's a story today, a few stories actually, courtesy of Salon and Mediaite, that uses as its source material an account called Right Wing Watch on Twitter. This, just like Media Matters, they look for things they can either take out of context or comments that are in context but are inconsequential as far as the movement is concerned to smear all Republicans. And so the title of this Mediaite story, let me read it to you because it caught my attention. Right-wing radio host calls for execution of Obama and others if Trump's indicted. Now, we're supposed to believe that this is some guy who represents right-wing thought or conservative thought. And of course, it's being used to smear quote-unquote right-wing radio. I get called a right-wing host all the time. I'm not entirely sure the folks who use it know what that means, but their intent is to try to shame me for being a conservative. When you say right-wing, the intent, I think, is for folks to label you an extremist. And of course, this guy is an extremist if it is, in fact, what he said. I believe it is. We'll play the audio in a second. But what was curious to me was, because I never heard of this guy, and I generally know even some of the regional radio hosts, I'm like, I don't think I've ever even heard this name whispered before. So I did what some of these journalists, in air quotes, should have done, which was just Google him. Because number one, I know Right Wing Watch as a Twitter feed, it's disingenuous. They look and find the craziest people and pretend that somehow they're mainstream. And that's exactly what they did here. Of course, you don't get that from these articles. Right Wing radio host, they call him. He's not on the radio. He doesn't have a radio show. This is a guy who does a podcast. A podcast that, again, virtually no one has heard of. But because he's crazy, they're able in some media, let's just call them outlets, on some media outlets, not all media does this, but they are basically using him to smear Republicans. And it's all part of this effort to pre-vet some storylines that they're trying to develop once Trump is indicted, if that actually happens, because there's going to inevitably be some dude who protests and acts out in an inappropriate way, whether it's just inappropriate with language or it could be criminal. And of course, the media will go overboard in covering that. They ignored all the Antifa violence and the BLM rioting that they pretend wasn't happening. And they focus exclusively on anything that comes from the right. And as I said yesterday, if some guy is running to a protest, trips and falls into someone, they will claim that that is an assault. And that's what they're basically doing here with Pete Santilli. Let's hear some of his podcast.
Get the military, whatever few are left.
And you could, here's the funny part. You can literally hear, based on the quality of the audio, that this is not a radio show.
That are going to side with the people that are standing there holding candles and banging pots and pans and expressing the will of the people. That you military personnel and you people with guns and badges and law enforcement will succumb to the will of the people. Okay. And ultimately, we absolutely demand that the criminals in this country, if you want them held accountable, the criminals are Barack Obama, Eric Holder, Susan Rice, all this entire criminal cabal that came about as a result of the murder of John F. Kennedy. The people that perpetrated the murder of John F. Kennedy, rise up to that. Military, join us and put all of them up against the concrete wall, just like Ceausescu.
Okay. So you can hear it in the quality of the audio, right? You can hear it. This is a guy who's in a basement doing a podcast. He might be video recording it and he posts it online. Again, I don't know even where this is distributed, but I know it's not on the radio. So what purpose does this serve? It serves the greater goal. They're trying to gin up folks into violence, pretending that the violence is occurring already or the calls for violence are already occurring. That's their intent. It's disingenuous and I would say it's dangerous. And again, it's one-sided. I would still be upset with the strategy, but if they did it to both sides, at least we can say they're consistent. We can say they're consistently crummy and disingenuous, but they're not even consistent. When was the last time you heard them in sort of left-wing media, whether we're talking about blogs or magazines or TV newscasts? When was the last time you heard them do this version of coverage for a lunatic on the left? They exist. We know they exist. There's Libs of TikTok as a Twitter account shows you that. When was the last time you heard anything, even remotely close to using a fringe voice on the left to explain away or characterize the entire left-wing movement from the media? I honestly can't think of any. The problem that they have is there are fewer and fewer lunatics, although they obviously exist, like this guy on the left. But some of the views that a decade ago we would have said are just fringe lunatic ideas, they're gaining momentum. And in a lot of ways, they've become mainstream on the left. And so they don't want to criticize anything that's coming from these movements like reparations. Anyone who looks at what's going on in San Francisco and one of the committee members on this board to determine the recommendations for reparations says that they're going to come up with a recommendation that that we should all consider breathtaking, in that we're going to step back and go, whoa, that's deep. That's a lot. So they're probably going to go more than the $5 million and all the other nonsense that they're pretending black San Franciscans are due. That is a crazy idea. Is it being portrayed as nutty in the media? Is it? They portray any effort to stop the gender extremism in schools or on children. They view that and present that and frame it as crazy, as fringe, as dangerous. They do that all the time in left-wing media, which is most media. They don't do that to their own causes. I would argue that pretending there are 17,000 genders is crazy, not the people who are trying to stop that from being taught to kids. And yet the side that's saying we don't want this in classrooms, if you want to do this as an adult, I guess go at it. But why are we doing this to like a 10-year-old? Why are we teaching them this? That's the side that's presented as crazy. Odd how that works, isn't it? It's transparent. We know exactly what they're doing. So be aware and don't fall into the trap of allowing anyone on our side to be smeared in this disingenuous way. But also be aware that there are crazies on both sides. And when you see the crazy, when you hear the crazy, point it out. I have no problem pointing out that Pete Santilli sounds like a lunatic. And he probably is a lunatic. I say that about folks on the left all the time, too. We got to make sure that we're critiquing our own side, even if they're fringe, like a Nick Fuentes, for example. 1-800-465-8770. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.